scholars, at least, as European barbaric colonialism coming home. E.B. Du Bois had that, and she cites two other scholars. She cites the scholar Michael Rothberg, who used to be on campus. In fact, he was founding director of the Holocaust and Memory place. I played him speaking at the Salida event last Sunday. I played it was a 10-year rough anniversary, sad anniversary. Michael Rothberg is now in Berlin, and he has participated just recently in something called the Big Chill or something like that. Don't have the details right in front of me about the suppression of dissent in Germany, because he's on a sabbatical in Berlin from his UCLA position. That's all very complicated, and but I was gratified to hear she cites his views in this segment that I'll be getting to at the second half hour. I haven't done anything about nuclear power in a while, so I've got a short segment from Up Front, Brian Edwards Tiekert interviewing somebody who is covering ecological issues and the mini nukes that will power your chat box. As if Bitcoin wasn't enough of a waste of energy, now we have competing data centers doing this plagiarism machine, that's Chomsky's term for AI, just voraciously devouring everything on the internet in their own singular ways, repeating all of the same computations over and over again, and just, sucking energy out of a system. And the idea that mini nukes and even a revival of the non-meltdown nuclear reactor at Three Mile Island that Microsoft is proposing. I haven't covered that, and that's because of the rush of events, but I thought a little short segment point some people maybe at this reporter's work. Okay, let's get the underwriting announcement in before I blink out. Radio Free Labor aforementioned coming up for a couple of hours in a bit. I have something from last night's event, a memory event, dedication of a mural to Dave Monk and Jenny, married to Jim Barrett, Jenny Barrett, active in the community. Tributes from dancers. There was a free dance in her memory at Channing Murray last night. But I'm going to play just Jim Barrett's piece, and I hope I did enough audio manipulation to make it sound okay. His memory. His son also spoke quite eloquently. He was involved in the labor struggle in Chicago that got new leadership to the school board and eventually a new mayor, of which he has some misgivings about. But anyway, hopefully that'll be presented on a YouTube, IMC YouTube channel, since the video will help people understand the words. Okay, here's an underwriting announcement, and then we'll get back to it. And I may have left something out that I'm going to play, but I'm not sure. Oh, Amy Goodman's usual commentary. And I think that's a wrap.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and Make It Champaign Urbana. Make It Champaign Urbana provides programs to assist new residents in getting connected to the community. You're invited to start discovering the area and find resources with the Champaign Welcome Crew. This community ambassador program connects newcomers to one of over 50 local ambassadors so you can get settled into your new home. For more information, visit makeitcu.com.
I think I'll go ahead and play Jim Barrett. I used to attend regular socialist forums meeting. He was quite influential. Jenny, of course, contributed and was at those meetings as well through time. But I regret not going out and dancing more. She seemed to dance all night at some of these special events. And it's a loss to the community, but her memory was served. And the mural is beautiful. It's in the ramp area of the entrance on the south side of the IMC, the old post office building in downtown Urbana. And I hope this comes over clearly.
Really, really wonderful work, along with many other people here. Jenny had many connections with the IMC. We had two different illnesses between the two of us over a fairly long period of time. That slowed that down, so some people may not be aware of that. Especially on the front end of the IMC when we were still raising money for it and kind of getting things organized. There were a lot of people that were involved in the formation of the IMC. It's on a night like tonight when you can see why it's important. We had the connection mainly through Socialist Forum, which I'll get back to in a minute. Jenny had birthdays here. The birthday is always in our dancing, which you can understand from Dan's remarks. What I remember from that is the Torinos playing, and they played a lot of places around here, but they did play at the IMC for Jenny's birthdays. I remember Irish music here. Charlie King will be back in town Sunday night, played here, Roy Zimmerman did, and so forth. Jenny was involved in some of this. happy to have Dan and other people from the Urbana Country Dancers. You could tell from what he had to say that contra dancing, English country dancing, and Scottish country dancing were very important to Dan, to Jenny. She was, as much as anything, a dancer, and that was a real passion of hers. I hated it, but Jenny liked it very, very much, and it was very important to her, and I realized that. Her art, I won't say too much about. It's covering our home, and you're all invited to my house to see that. It's up on all of our walls. She won many different awards for the art. And it was the stuff that she painted, which I thought was interesting. I won't go into any detail on it, but she was very interested, especially in landscape, including some of the landscapes around here, but especially in urban landscapes. Very much an urban kid and in love with the city from an early age. I did want to remind people, I think a lot of people here would know it, but some of the younger people might not. And it's important to say, I think, because I think maybe we're too careful these days about talking about politics. Jenny was a radical, really, all of her life. The organizing for the APs was mentioned. One of her big disappointments was that she got some of the APs organized. There's a whole group of them that are under contract. But the main group, she didn't, and her colleagues like Dan and other people didn't quite manage to get a contract. Something like that has happened with the faculty as well. So the non-tenure track faculty are all organized and under contract at Illinois, partly through the efforts of some people here. But she did that. She was kind of important in a quiet way in Carol Ammon's campaign, not just for fundraising, but she did a lot of digital work. Maybe that's not the right term, but they managed to reach out to more people than they would have been able to because Jenny worked on that. Early on, she was involved in something called Women Against Racism, and they focused on a number of different things, but they were definitely part of the movement that got rid of the racist mascot at the University of Illinois. Choice of acronym.
War.
Yeah. Tough character. Jobs with Justice, Socialist Forum, and a number of other groups that Jenny was important in. So I wanted to end with the mural, which is why we're here tonight, and to thank May again. And if you look at the mural in general, but especially the buttons on the mural, I think that between the beauty of the mural I have to say, at the risk of disappointing Maya, that the mural's very beautiful. It's not as beautiful as Jenny, but pretty close. I was going to say that I think Maya's captured each of these sort of elements there. The dance, the art, and the, of course, the activism. And many years, I hope, Tony Wong, Jenny's nephew, is here tonight with his family, and Sean, my son, and my daughter, Erin, and my granddaughter, Siobhan, are here. And I was just thinking about something that Tony asked me. Tony is a scientist, so you'll have to forgive him. What he wanted to know is, how long is that paint going to last on the mural? And what? But that was good, because it reminded me that hopefully, many years from now, when Siobhan, who lives on the south side in Chicago with Sean and his family, but spends a lot of time with Grandpa down here, and hopefully when she visits over the years, this mural will be here, and it will remind her of her grandmother and what her grandmother stood for. So thanks a lot to everybody, especially to me.
That was Jim Barrett from a memorial event and the opening of a mural, beautiful mural in the back of the IMC, Independent Media Center in downtown Urbana. Jim Barrett, Emeritus Professor of History, specializing in labor history and particularly stuff about Chicago. He mentioned Charlie King having house concerts. I don't have details on that. I don't know if they been on the air in some of the folk shows this week, but one of them features him, I don't know if working with or alongside of Rick Burkhart, who used to live in town and was part of a great group, a duo called the Prince Mishkins. And one of the things I thought about today, and I probably won't get to it, is Holly Near picked up one of his songs called The Ministry of Oil, written at the time of the Iraq invasion, pointing out that Baghdad had been laid waste, but the place where all the details about the oil extraction was not hit. I'm going to break format again and not play Amy Goodman. I'm going to put Amy Goodman right in front of Naomi Klein, where I've heard her most. She should be out more since she's writing about people going down the rabbit hole in her book Doppelganger, Naomi Wolf being misrecognized for her and vice versa all the time. There's a complicated story there, and I have a question for her, but I still haven't written her about it. The other thing I do is work on the Friday Forum series. I'm quite intrigued by the fact that the Y is put together a pair of people to talk about understanding white Christian nationalism, which includes a screening of the film Bad Faith about white Christian nationalism. That'll be screened at the Y the night before. It is available for free on an app called Tubi. I don't know if you have to give them your principles. I don't think so. I think it's a free view, but I haven't looked at it yet. But you can check out the trailer online and see the visuals. But I thought why not play the trailer audio from the trailer for Bad Faith, Christian Nationalism's Unholy War on Democracy.
Everything can be reduced to right and wrong. Make no mistake about it. We are talking about Christianizing America.
That which God has given us, we will allow no one to take away.
The Supreme Court has overturned Roe v. Wade.
That's a blessing.
We will make America great again.
It's time.
effort asks people to come out of the churches.
Christian nationalism uses religion to justify all kinds of evil.
Christian nationalism has been a political tool for centuries.
It has nothing to do with Christianity. It's about power and politics.
The goal was to enshrine Christian identity as the law of the land.
To reclaim the United States for God.
You can't take over society unless you take over the seven pillars. And they've gone one by one to do it.
We want total war.
We are the Christian Taliban.
We need to force the people to believe what we believe.
When government is in the hands of godly men, it is good. But in the hands of all others, it is evil.
Okay, if you want to watch that with a group, you can go to the YMCA on Thursday night, and then it'll be discussed, not by William Barber, who we heard there, of the Poor People's Campaign, another uncovered phenomena in the U.S. It'll be covered by a discussion facilitated by Reverend Terrence Thomas of the Bethel AME Church, the oldest African-American church in Champaign-Urbana, and Father, Prelate, I guess PR stands for Prelate, Michael Crosby of the First Mennonite Church of Champaign-Urbana, Lincoln and University. Next week's Friday Forum is Supreme Court and Democracy by Stephen D. Schwinn of the Uvalde Law School. Okay, time is clicking, and I'm still mixed about where I'm going to go first. I just announced maybe I'll do it that way. I put Amy Goodman's commentary about Gaza and Sinwar and the urgency of a ceasefire need. Put that right before the Naomi Klein segment from a Jacobin interview, wide-ranging, just the section where she talks about her Guardian article.
Everything can be reduced.
Yes. Her Guardian article is called How Israel Has Made Trauma a Weapon of War. Her book is Doppelganger, Trip into the Mirror World. But now for something completely different, and that's a short segment of about 11 minutes of talking about another apocalyptic possibility, I guess, in a way, if you are worried about nuclear power the way I am. I was with the Prairie Alliance many decades ago trying to stop Clinton from being built and actually calling for it to be made safer in some instances, if that isn't a contradiction in terms. This is just a snapshot of business about the tech companies wanting to power their chatbots with nuclear power. Brian Edwards Tiekert from the show Upfront, I guess it was just Friday, not sure, no, middle of the week.
Medical worker.
My name is Brian Edwards Tiekert. We're going to turn now to a different environmental story. An increasing number of tech giants looking for sources of energy to power their incredibly electricity hungry data and computing centers are turning to nuclear power. You probably saw the headlines about Microsoft inking a contract to finance the reopening of the reactor at Three Mile Island. More recently, Google has signed a contract with a startup named Kairos Power to develop a fleet of small modular nuclear reactors using a design that currently doesn't have regulatory approval on a timeline that wouldn't deliver any electricity before the year 2030. Joining us to talk about it, Eric Wiesoff, the executive director at Canary Media. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian.
Maybe start with the basics of the concept, a modular nuclear reactor. How is that different from the very big nuclear power plants most of us are familiar with?
Sure. Thanks. Great to be here, by the way. The United States leads the world in the amount of nuclear power it generates. We have 93 operating nuclear reactors in the United States, and they're all of the large variety, the one that probably comes to mind when you think of a nuclear reactor, you typically think of cooling towers, but those are large 1,000 megawatt reactors that can power essentially a city. There is a trend, a theoretical trend happening in the nuclear industry of moving towards smaller nuclear reactors. Now, it's not an engineering, it's an engineering solution to a financial problem. The United States has had an enormous problem building these large 1,000 megawatt nuclear reactors. In fact, we've seen a large amount of those closed down recently. And a piece of wisdom in the nuclear industry is that by changing the way we build these nuclear reactors, instead of these large cathedral type projects that are built on site in these massive 1,000 laborer efforts, if we could make smaller reactors of 300 megawatts, of 100 megawatts instead of 1,000 megawatts, perhaps we could build some of these, the components for these nuclear reactors in factories and ship them to the site rather than having to construct these massive construction projects on site. And so this is the concept that small modular reactors can provide a solution to our inability to build large nuclear reactors and the stagnation of the nuclear industry for the last 15 years. That's the theory. And that's what folks, large data center behemoths like Microsoft and Amazon and Oracle and Meta and Google are banking on, this holy grail of small modular reactors.
It's theoretically a solution to a business problem. Does the idea of a modular design address any of the safety or environmental concerns that have dogged the industry? The impacts of uranium mining, high-level waste disposal, the potential for catastrophic accidents?
I would say that small modular reactors do not address any of the nuclear waste, safety, or other issues. They are simply a way of allowing utilities to lose money in smaller chunks. So I don't think it's absolutely true. Utilities have actually said something to that saying that we don't have to lose $8 billion at a time. We can lose $1 billion at a time.
What is the appeal to the tech industry specifically? I mean, every headline from renewable energy is about like how fast solar is getting ridiculously cheap and how batteries are on the same curve, making it possible to store some of that solar energy and use it after the sun goes down. Why make a bet on nuclear energy that wouldn't pay off for at least 6 years?
You're absolutely correct. Solar power, energy storage have been going through semiconductor-like price drops, courtesy of something analogous to Moore's law, of just, it's as if you could buy a car for $5,000 20 years ago, and now it costs you $1,000, $500. That's the type of price reductions we're seeing. Now, it's not apples to apples. Nuclear power has the ability to provide power 24/7. So if you need to do if you need to make an urgent Google query in the middle of the night, there's always power from nuclear power to do that. Solar and wind are not what are considered firm energy and are subject to things like day and night. However, there are batteries that can store this and can store the renewable energy and parcel it out when it is dark, when the sun isn't shining, when the wind isn't blowing. But there is a necessity in the world, in the US grid, to have firm, clean power. And nuclear power does, on the surface, seem like it would provide that.
Firm is what the industry would call baseload generation, something that's cranking out energy around the clock, basically.
That's what the industry refers to it. But we have countries running to a great extent on a large percentage of renewable energy. So the conventional wisdom, the myth that you have to have this reserve of baseload energy, is being challenged by our current situation, our current grid, and the amount of penetration that we have with renewables.
is Google taking an equity stake? In other words, is this just a tech giant looking for energy, or are they making a bet that the technology will prove profitable and they can make money off that as well?
There's been a wave of announcements from not only Google, as you mentioned, but from Microsoft and from Oracle and from Meta. And all of these agreements, some of them take in the form of a memorandum of understanding, an MOU, which is one of the more worthless agreements one can make. So that's just a pledge to do good things. In the case of the recent Microsoft deal, Microsoft is actually investing tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, in a particular startup, a nuclear startup called X Energy. By the way, I want to make a point that all of the SMRs, the small modular reactors that are being discussed in these conversations with Meta, Google, and these other data oligarchs, are not licensed reactors. They haven't gone through any type of permitting process with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the entity that creates the laws and rules on how you install and permit nuclear reactors. So none of these reactors are permitted. That is a multi-year, sometimes a multi-decade process that the NRC puts nuclear reactors and companies through to make sure that they're safe. And in fact, these small modular reactors that are being posited for these data centers, their designs have not been approved, and their designs are dissimilar to the fleet of nuclear reactors we currently have, which are called light water reactors. These are of different varieties and flavors, and they've never been tested. They've never been deployed en masse, and they are being relied on as a holy grail, and we don't have information about them.
Right. Even if you have a standardized design, you don't have standardized site conditions. One might go in on a fault line, another might go in on a floodplain. Those would seem to require different safety measures to mitigate the hazard.
Yes, that's true. But we build big projects in earthquake areas, in floodplains, all the time. What's happening in the United States nuclear industry is that we're building interminable first of a kinds. We're constantly building the first design, and there's no way to drive down the cost on a learning curve. What the Department of Energy would like to do is build these larger reactors similar to what we've built in the past, and just build dozens of them so that we can iterate and drive the cost down, keep the safety, keep the reliability, and potentially lower the cost of nuclear that has always been higher than any other energy source. We've been promised that nuclear would be too cheap to meter. It's the opposite of that. It's bankrupting companies, utilities, and causing utility rates for ratepayers to go up.
How much of this is about the AI boom, the power-hungry data centers that are running graphic processing units to create incredibly annoying chatbots and features that no one asked for on their web experience?
This is it's the looming threat of this AI, this AI future, which you've noted is in poor taste, seemingly. This is the source of demand for electricity in the United States for the next couple of years. I leave it to you to make a judgment on the value of AI. It's supposed to change the way we live, work, and play. That might not deliver the tech promise that's being made on it. But that, again,
might not
is
pay off for investors. It wouldn't be the first time there was a bubble in the tech sector. Eric Weisoff, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure to be here. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Eric Weisoff is the executive director of Canary Media. That is an outlet that covers climate change and technology, not the similarly named outlet that doxes campus activists who express solidarity with Palestinians. That takes us to...
And that's Brian Edwards-Tiekert, and he set the stage for me playing Amy Goodman and then Naomi Klein. I'm going to get to that straight away to get as much as Naomi Klein's conversation on the Jacobin podcast. Recent article, I think it was on October 7th, in the Guardian magazine. I'll verify that after we hear Amy Goodman breaking the sound barrier essay.
Medical workers demand a ceasefire in Gaza. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Palestinians in Gaza have endured more than a year of Israel's constant bombardment, ground assaults with tanks and troops, sniper fire, displacement, and starvation. Armed drones constantly buzz overhead, a reminder that no place in Gaza is safe and that death could come at any moment. Over 42,000 Gazans have been killed already. Prior to Hamas's raid on Israel on October 7, 2023, the Gaza Strip was considered the world's largest open-air prison, with its impoverished population of 2.3 million walled in by the Israeli military since 2006. Half the population of Gaza is under the age of 18, born under siege, raised while denied adequate access to clean water, education, employment, nutrition, and freedom of movement. The scale of the violence that Israel, with full U.S. support, is raining on Palestinians in Gaza is without precedent and is widely considered an ongoing genocide. One of Israel's stated goals has been to kill Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, which it claims to have done in Rafah on Wednesday. Will Israel now accept a ceasefire, and will the hostages in Gaza come home? Apparently not. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the war will go on. The protests in Tel Aviv against Netanyahu, led by the families of hostages, continue. News of the situation in Gaza is hard to obtain, as Israel's barred foreign journalists from entering. Palestinian journalists in Gaza have been doing remarkable reporting, but Israel's killed well over 120 of them in the past year. Some of the best firsthand accounts of the horrors have come from foreign medical workers. This week, the New York Times published an opinion piece titled "65 Doctors, Nurses, and Paramedics, What We Saw in Gaza," written by Dr. Feroz Sidwa, who volunteered for 2 weeks at the European Hospital in Khan Yunis, Gaza. Sidwa wrote, quote, "I worked as a trauma surgeon in Gaza from March 25th to April 8th. Nearly every day I was there, I saw a new young child who'd been shot in the head or the chest, virtually all of whom went on to die, 13 in total," unquote. The article included 3 X-ray images showing the upper body of different Palestinian children. Each showed a bullet lodged in the head or neck.
I think it's pretty clear that when there's a pattern of, if in every catchment, in the catchment area of every hospital in Gaza, every time any international has been around, for an entire year, on a daily basis, a child has been shot in the head in a place of 2 million people. It seems unlikely to me that that's an accident.
Dr. Sidwa said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. Reja Musla is a Palestinian nurse who grew up in Gaza. She worked in Gaza City, trapped at one point in the Al-Shifa hospital for over 40 days.
We receive at the hospital a huge number of injured persons coming to the emergency department, and the majority of the cases, unfortunately, women and children.
Musla said on Democracy Now!
Many people or many children come without legs, without arms, and even I'm witness a father like hold his children in 2 bags.
She described the guilt she felt when compelled to leave a dying 10-year-old girl in order to attend to others who had a chance of living.
9% of her body was burned, and she asked me to stay beside her and hold her hand until the moment. I will never, ever forget her burned skin at my hands. Until the moment I feel that. Until the moment I feel guilty because I did not obey or stay beside her in the bed because she requested that, and I did not do that. Until the moment I feel guilty when she asked me about her mother and father and sister, brothers, and I cannot respond to her request because the whole family has been killed during bombing her house.
Raja Musla continued,
I will never forget the dogs were eating the dead body inside Shifa Hospital at the front of the emergency department.
Netanyahu and his war cabinet are agitating for a wider war, promising an imminent attack on Iran as the United States has sent Israel a high-tech missile defense battery and 100 U.S. troops to operate it. The U.S. also used B-2 stealth bombers to strike Yemen this week. Forgotten amidst the geopolitics, beneath the warplanes and the uninterrupted flow of arms from the U.S. to Israel are both the Palestinian civilians trapped with no safe place in Gaza and the remaining Israeli hostages seemingly sacrificed by Netanyahu as just another cost of his endless war. Meanwhile, trauma surgeon Feroz Sidwa will continue telling the world what he saw in Gaza.
I personally wish that Americans could see more of what it looks like when a child is shot in the head, when a child is filleted open by bombs. I think it would make us think a little bit more about what we do in the world.
I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
My name's Brian.
And if you heard Counterspin from Fairness and Accuracy reporting you on the segment on how the media is covering the war, they mentioned the New York Times' explicit policy of not showing traumatic injuries. I'm breathless. Here is an interviewer at Jacobin. Podcast doesn't give his name. Maybe he'll introduce on the way out. Actually, we won't get all the way to the end of this segment. This is Down the Rabbit Hole with Naomi Klein. It's about her book Doppelganger. On most of it, but the last segment, which I'm excerpting here, is about her views on the Middle East and the genocide, she uses the word, in Gaza. And the date on the Guardian article, How Israel Has Made Trauma a Weapon of War, is October 5th, so a bit ago, but Naomi Klein.
QAnon story just talks about a great storm and the white hats and arresting all the bad guys and sending them to Guantanamo and then they get back to sort of normal, right? But the more deeply encoded story is actually apocalypse.
A theoretical trend.
You know, it's swimming with the tides because you and yours will be
amongst the elect.
Exactly. I mean, and that's in a way, that's just a description of current socioeconomic and racial realities, you know, that I will be okay. I think I will be okay. I'm going to build my, it's not a golden castle in the sky, but it's going to be my sort of fortress for my family.
A fortress in New Zealand, say.
Say, yeah. But I think we might not be, and this partly this is just me being influenced by my recent conversation with Anoni, who really believes that, you know, having grown up in a sort of Irish Catholic family, that we're not reckoning enough with the deep encoding of the apocalyptic narratives, that actually you want collapse because collapse is salvation. And more than wanting collapse, you know, I was asking her about the connection between the attacks on trans folks, attacks on, you know, reproductive rights, and attacks on the earth, because I think they're all connected. And obviously, like, they are a common agenda on the right, that, you know, this idea that, you know, we can extract, we have a right to dominate the earth, we have a right to control women, we have a right to control our children. And it's all this sort of toxic nostalgia and an assertion of sort of dominance, and at least, you know, a sphere of control that is the family, right? And the earth, like, the earth as dominion, right? And climate change is a message that the earth is actually not our dominion and that we're not in as control as we thought we were. And ask anyone who was impacted by a recent megastorm. They saw that force and that fury. But there's more to it than that, which is actually a kind of a hatred of the body and a hatred of the earth, because heaven is transcendence from it. And, you know, the role of these apocalyptic religions in the rise of the far right. And I look at somebody like Russell Brand, you know, who I watched change, right? The last thing I saw, he was baptizing people. So many of these
videos, you know, are wild.
Right. So many of these folks end up actually in a kind of an evangelical space. It all kind of seems to lead there. Wolf flirts with it all the time. She's been quoting biblical verses nonstop.
And she's Jewish.
Yeah, but she's Jewish. She's Christian. She's definitely curious. But listen, just being Jewish is no protection, because I think that, you know, the extent to which, you know, people in the Netanyahu government, like Smotrich and Ben-Gavir, the extent to which they are fully within this apocalyptic vision in coalition with Christian Zionists, you know, and they, you know, they fully intend to destroy Al-Aqsa and build the
driving towards a final conflagration.
Yeah, they are. And so I think we might not be contending enough with some of the deepest stories in our culture in terms of understanding what is going on.
So what do we do with this dynamic underway? The left story is maybe something like there's no one to save us but us. And then the right has this really built-in terrifying advantage where we're worsening social and political conditions and ecological conditions make the case for a sort of right-wing accelerationism? How do we respond to that?
So you're asking me to give the rally speech that I don't give.
No, I mean, what is like less of a pep talk and more just like what's our story?
Yeah, I mean it's interesting because in some ways the story that I said I can't tell right anymore, which is that rallying story of like if we do these things and then we're going to get to like the perfect Green New Deal utopia. You know, I do think that we have the power to mitigate a lot of the pain that is headed our way. I still believe in these sort of huge transfers of like if we think about what we're spending on military right now and what it would look like to devote those types of resources on the infrastructure of care and repair, you know, it would make a huge difference in terms of, you know, a weather event like a heat dome leads to thousands of people dying or whether, you know, they're able to live in conditions where there's some kind of cooling. And, you know, I mean, like, it really does matter whether we make these investments. I do think that we, like, in a way, that story is it's still a salvation story. And I think maybe we need to be moving away from this idea that there's like a kind of a perfect happy ending that we get.
Right.
And that we are in the trouble and we're in the rubble. Like, you know, some of the images from the covers of newspapers this past week where you see like images of massive flooding, whether it's here in the U.S. or whether in Nepal and then you see the rubble in Lebanon. And it's just sometimes you can't tell whether you're looking at a climate disaster or, you know, an Israeli military strike. And, you know, I think about Benjamin a lot and the sort of the rubble of history just piling up and piling up. And so I think we are in the rubble. And here's a line at the end of the shock doctrine that we have to get away from the idea of building from scratch, but we are building from scrap. You know, it is a kind of a rusty future, but there, you know, there are possibilities. I think about sort of the world building of somebody like Kim Stanley Robinson. But I mean, even when I think about some of the writing that I've been doing lately of trying to understand how the Holocaust was misremembered and is still misremembered and how that brought us to this conflagration and genocide, or the genocide of Palestinians. I think a lot of it has to do with this sort of narrative structure of wanting happy endings that is actually incredibly dangerous, right? Because if I think about the Holocaust education, that is the standard Holocaust education that I grew up with, that most people in the West did, it's like, it's this just unimaginable horror and trauma and then Israel, right? And Israel it's the redemption. Like the trauma is immediately instrumentalized towards statecraft, towards state building.
Because thus any attack on Israel is Nazism 2.0 by that logic.
Right. Well, that's, yeah. But beyond that, you know, I think when I try to understand how unhinged my own community is, right, like large parts of my own community is, I think a lot of it has to do with how much our culture has foregrounded Holocaust education while simultaneously instrumentalizing it as statecraft, which means that is unprocessed trauma, right? So this is trauma that is passed from one generation to the next. It's a central part of identity for Jews everywhere. You know, when I look at the kind of education that I got, I think it was almost abusive, like to sort of tell us that we were in so much danger all the time and it could happen at any moment. But we weren't actually feeling it because it was there was the immediate pivot. It's like what Bannon does, right? It's like you tap into something real, but then you immediately pivot and it's like, actually, it's all immigrants' faults, right? So in our education, it was like, we were sort of traumatized, but then it was like, but Israel will protect us, right? And it immediately gets pivot into this nationalist project. But what that means is that if that nationalist project turns out to have been a very, very bad idea, then that means that you have to confront this genocide, but you also actually have to confront the last genocide, which doesn't get a happy ending. It means like trauma stays and we can mitigate, but we don't get that happy ending.
And that genocide was a boomerang from prior colonial genocides.
Exactly. You know, and I think that, you know, part of this is like trauma doesn't make us special. Like most people in the world have survived trauma and most people in the world don't get a happy ending. You know, we just try to build a better world from it and we can build solidarities through it. So I think it's, you know, the structure of it has to be, it can't follow the same structure of a kind of a pure utopian moment. I think that might be what is at the core of a lot of this.
Right. Instead of happy endings, maybe what we need to take from Bannon, from studying Bannon, the way he's been studying us, is that we need a war room to strategize, not for an inclusive reactionary nationalist movement, but for an inclusive liberatory movement. And obviously, world building and utopian thinking is helpful and can be helpful as a North Star. But what we need is strategy.
We definitely need strategy. when we talk about the scale of these crises, if you think you have to deal with it as an individual, you would immediately throw up your hands and give up, right? I mean, you probably have one area that you've decided is your area, or maybe two, right? And you know, the beautiful part of being part of a mass movement is that what strategy means is it's saying, okay, you're going to do your thing and I'm going to do my thing. And this is where these things fit together into a coherent vision of how we together are going to get from here to there, right? It allows for us to take different pieces of it, but know that as we focus on our piece, we are part of this this broader movement. And I've only, you know, I've only had moments where I have felt that, you know, and the Bernie campaign was the closest to it, frankly, where it was that feeling of like, okay, there are a lot of us here and we're taking different pieces of it. But, you know, a presidential election campaign is not a mass movement. And I think we got confused about that. But I think that that's the kind of thing that we need to build on an ongoing basis. We need to rebuild the left, which is part of the rubble of our moment. And, you know, I realize I'm not giving a rally speech. I don't have it in me this morning. You know, we're talking on October 7th. I think we have to be suspicious of anybody, including people on our own quote unquote side, who hold out this idea of a kind of a moment where everything is going to be okay. Like if that was ever true, we have missed that moment. And so the futures that we need to build have to be, you know, they have to be honest enough that they admit that we are organizing in rubble. But that doesn't mean like we can choose who we want to be in that. I think that that's the really key part of it is like that's the sovereignty is like who we want to be in these very difficult futures, like how we want to treat each other, whether everybody's going to be allowed to see themselves in that future, the extent to which we place a cherishing of life at the center, the extent to which we prioritize joy and art in that future. Like we have a lot of choices to make and there can be a beautiful future, but I don't think it is a moment. It's a practice. We're going to have to practice it together. We're going to have to remind ourselves every day that that's how we're choosing to live.
I want to talk about Gaza in a moment, but first, I think another really important lesson from that in terms of just the relentless sectarianism and division within the left is that we should all have some humility and understand that none of us should be so confident that we know the way forward. Because what we know is that we're losing and that we have to try a lot of different things. And we should extend some grace to one another in that knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, losing is really painful, right? And so I think some of the harshness on the left comes from that. And I, you know, I do feel like on the North American left, part of not having good left institutions, sturdy left institutions, it means that, you know, one of the things that we don't have space for are these sort of moments of, you know, in Latin America, they call autocritica. You know, I always remember that when we were made the film, The Take in Argentina, you know, that when we did some filming with the Picatero movement, the unemployed workers movements that would block roads. And after every bloqueo, they would have a session where they would just sit around and talk about what they did wrong. And it wasn't nasty. It was just like, yeah. You know, when you ask people to go out in the streets and face the cops, it's, you know, of course you have to hold yourself accountable in some way.
So you can do better next time.
Yeah, that's all. That's all.
And then eventually win, ideally.
I mean, yeah, let's not look too closely at what's happening in Argentina right now. But but the point.
Not enough. Falta autocrítica.
You know, I am self-critical. I'm critical of myself. I'm critical of my own narcissism and brand centricness and all the ways that I've, you know, tried to burnish my brand in this attention economy. And
you were a very important brand to me as a child, as a teenager in the anti-globalization movement.
That's the sweetest thing anyone's ever said to me. yeah. I mean, I really do think that we should catch ourselves whenever we're feeling too righteous and too able to be like, you are the one and you know, who's guilty of this and not me. I mean, we are all, like this system has left its imprint on us, right? This is like nobody is outside of it. You know, and any oppressive, like even if we are victims of it, oppressive systems leave an imprint on their victims. I mean, this is another way that I understand Zionism, is that the oppressors of Jews left their imprint on us as a people and changed us. And I also think that that Zionism is leaving its imprint on the people it's oppressing. It's just the way oppression works.
Colombian President Gustavo Petro has argued that Gaza really is already boomeranging back to the West and that the West is boomeranging into Gaza, that Gaza is a laboratory for all the millions of people in and migrants from the global South whose deaths due to climate change and war we are currently being conditioned to accept as normal. Petro describing the global middle class, quote, Hitler has already entered their homes. He asks, quote, is this future of a generalized Gaza against the growing exodus of our people avoidable? How do you make sense of this boomerang that's underway, swinging back and forth between extreme violence on the colonial periphery and at the borders, between the First World and Third, between all that and fascist politics at home?
Yeah, I think Petro's been such an important voice in this period, and I think he saw it right away in October. You know, he was saying it's global 1933, took a lot of flack for it. One thing I just want to say is, you know, I think about a scholar who I have so much respect for, Shanine Seheli. She really rejects this idea of Gaza as a laboratory, Palestine as a laboratory. It's a place, it's a people.
Right.
And I think it's one of the challenges of coalition politics is like, how do we hold on to like specificities of struggle and build coalitions based on commonalities? And I don't think that that's what Petro was saying. But I do just want to be clear that I don't like that language very much. I think Israel's military is a laboratory, which is different than saying Palestine is a laboratory. But this, you know, this is how what we can learn from the fact that Israel's post-Oslo economy boomed in the absence of any kind of peace on the horizon, so-called peace, right? And the collapse of the so-called peace process was a warning to a sort of a future of disaster capitalism as a continual state for capitalism careening from shock to shock, right? By which I mean, yes, I know capitalism is a disaster all the time and so on. But the point is that the building of walls, the selling of surveillance gear, the exporting of all of this technology was a big part of why Israel lost the incentive to peace, right? Because it used to be that a lot of the discourse for why Israel needed a peace agreement with Palestinians was that its economy depended on it. But then there was this post-Oslo, after the sort of startup nation bubble emerged, there was this new discourse that you could have security without peace and that you could have prosperity without it, just through containment, just through mass containment. And by privatizing that and exporting it, that you could have a booming economy. And Israel did have that for a long time. I mean, that economy is in trouble right now, but it may well rebound. And, you know, I wrote a piece, or I gave a speech and was published as a text a few months ago called The Iron Dome is Global. And I do think that that is a helpful way of understanding the solidarities of Western states with Israel, in that the geographic proximity of, you know, Gaza to southern Israel is a super hyper intensified version of what is happening on a global scale between north and south. And every, you know, whether it's the EU, whether it's the US and Canada, whether it's Australia with its offshore migrant detention facilities, the Iron Dome is here. It is high tech. The technologies are flying between our governments. I would include Modi's government in that. It isn't just a global north-south. And everybody wants to have their Iron Dome. Trump is explicit about it. He says, Israel's got an Iron Dome. We should have the best Iron Dome, right? But I think that the investments in Israel have to do with our own country's colonial investments. You mentioned the boomerang. I mean, I think that if we want to understand why the US, Canada, Europe, Australia, you know, all the settler colonial and colonial states have stood by Israel in the way that it has, we're back in the Second World War and how it was misunderstood and how it was never confronted what European fascism actually was, which was a doppelganger of European colonialism and imperialism, which is what Nehru, Cesar, Du Bois, Padmore were all saying at the time, that this is not a rupture, this is a homecoming. And because that was, it's not that it was misunderstood, it was suppressed. It was out in the open. I mean, Hitler was constantly drawing connections. I didn't invent the concentration camp, the British did. He compared the Ukrainians to the North American, you know, quote unquote, Indian people. He said, we'll give them glass beads, like all the colonized people like. All the eugenic, the migration of eugenics, the extent to which you have these straight lines from the race science in what is now Namibia and the genocide of the Nama and Herero people. And, you know, some of the key figures go and train, you know, people like Mengele, the fact that Hitler read this race science, you know, when he was in prison writing Mein Kampf. I mean, it's not like a swervy line. It's a straight line.
And Lebensraum and Westward and Manifest Destiny.
Yeah. And also, you know, they lost their colonies after the First World War. So they colonized internally, right? So it's all enmeshed. But the story that I grew up with was like the Allies were the good guys, the great guys. They defeated Hitler. I mean, so we end up with this story that actually cleanses settler colonial nations and powers like Britain, you know, who are part of the Allies. They don't have, not only do they not have to look in the mirror at how we're all complicit in the rise of fascism in Europe, that this was a group project, but they emerge heroic and cleansed, right? So less likely to look at those at those paths. So, and then the project just continues, and the mantle of whiteness is passed to Israelis, and it's called reparations, but it's replication. It's replication of the same logics that were never confronted. So this is another of the many unveilings that we're in right now, like a true rendezvous with history, and the South African case against Israel at the ICJ has become this, where you know, yes, it is this devastating, you know, marshalling of the facts that build the case for genocide, but it's also Namibia stepping forward and intervening and saying to Germany, you know, how dare you side with Israel, you know, when you haven't even reckoned with the genocide against the Nama and Herero. And it's now Chile intervening and so on. So,
and we see echoes of that boomerang right now.
Echoes of the boomerang that you've never heard about. That was Naomi Klein with an interviewer at the Jacobin website. You can find that where you listen to podcasts. It's an hour and 40 minutes. We heard parts of the last section where she's talking about her article and broader things, her article in The Guardian from a couple of weeks ago, How Israel Weaponized Trauma, I believe was the title. And I think she mentioned the, I guess I lost that thread. Charlie King and Rick Burkhardt house concert. Go to Charlie King with an IE in it if you're interested in that, charlieking.org. Folk singer extraordinaire. I'm going to play at least a little bit of Holly Near's version of Rick Burkhardt's song, The Ministry of Oil, going back to the Iraq era. I also should mention in the genre of folk, there is a benefit concert at the Mennonite Center at 902 West Springfield that WEFT is involved with through Kevin Elliott. He's the impresario and the opening performer for Alice DeMichele. It's a benefit concert for the Red Cloud Renewable Lakota, the Yuya Dome House Project, which is part of the U.S.'s colonial settler history, the legacy. RedCloudRenewable.org for information about the project. And let's see if this comes up the way I want it to. Holly Near with a Rick Burkhardt song.
From people who think bombs can be precise. We hear the price of fighting terrorism. From people who don't have to pay that price. We see a cloud where there should be a college. We see a reservoir reduced to soil. And though they now admit that the marketplace was hit,
they didn't hit the Ministry of Oil. What they call a military target is sacred to all soldiers brave and loyal. You can bomb a shrine, you can bomb a power line, but you never bomb the Ministry of Oil. Once again, the mayhem they call warfare is followed by the melee they call peace. Tearing through the stores and the museums while the U.S. Army played police. How much do you suppose that artwork sold for as their last remaining food began to spoil? The situation's bad, but no place in Baghdad is safe.
in the